कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंदा जय चैतन्य राधा।
The following is a lecture given by His Holiness Jayapataka Swami on May 30th, 1984 in New Orleans, Louisiana. The class begins with a reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, chapter 8, verse 8 and 9.
Performing the reformatory process for Krishna would give rise to many doubts.
so that Kamsa might take very severe steps to kill the child. Kamsa had already sent many demons to attempt to kill this child, but none of them had survived. If Gargamuni were to perform the purificatory process, Kamsa's suspicions would be fully confirmed, and he would take very severe steps. Gargamuni gave this warning to Nanda Maharaj. Thus ends the translation purport by His Divine Grace Avaicharan Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada of the Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, 8th chapter, 8th and 9th verse, in the matter of Lord Krishna shows the universal form. Nanda and Yasoda are not aware that Krishna is the son of Devaki and Vasudeva. Naturally, they think that Krishna is their own child. And they're very concerned that all the Vedic rites, in the Vedas, they're called Dasa Karmas, or 10 purificatory processes for a spiritually advanced human being. Beginning from the Garbhodan Samskara, then there's the Pumsava ceremony during pregnancy, then here Nanda Maharaj wants to have the Namakarana, or the name giving, which is something like baptism in the Christian faith, when one is given a name officially by a priest with various ceremonies. Similarly, there's cutting the first hair is a ceremony, taking the first grains, which are offered to Krishna, like that, giving of Brahmin initiation or the Upanayan. There's so many different ceremonies which are performed for purifying the child before birth and even up till after leaving this body and till after death. So Nanda Maharaj, he was very concerned that when he had a son, that it should be, when he had a child, that all these ceremonies should be performed. But God really is warning him that if I do it, there's all these dangers. Indirectly, Gargamuni is revealing that Krishna is actually the son of Devaki and Vasudeva. But of course, Nanda Maharaj, he doesn't pick that up. He just sees that, yes, this is a dangerous coincidence. And Kamsa, he may go after Krishna. So, one thing is to see that how the Vedic culture, that at every step, the various ceremonies are especially meant for encouraging one in one's spiritual advancement. Gargamuni is a twice born, Ananda Maharaj is a Vaishya, the second born, Brahmana, Kshatriya, and Vaishya, they would always undergo all of these performing purificatory ceremonies. Just as today, parents want to send their children to college, they think this is like a purificatory process. If you go to college, you're twice born or something. You're then you become civilized. Of course, the colleges haven't necessarily produced, in other parts of the world especially, colleges are the best place for producing political activists, terrorists, for destroying people's morals, and for so many other things. Of course, to some extent, you can get some aspects of a mature education also, but especially destroying for the character. Well, the Vedic college course begins before birth. That basically, if one is going to be a twice born, or one is going to be a developed human being, then the parents would take very special care that at every stage of life, the child gets the benefit of the spiritual association and spiritual ceremonies. It's more than a ceremony, it's actual spiritual purification. This is another proof that from birth, nobody is pure. From birth, everyone is in an impure or in an undeveloped, unspiritual state. Born just like an animal's born. They're born simply with the animalistic characteristic, but it's due to spiritual culture, due to spiritual purification, that the higher traits, the higher development of an individual towards spiritual realization is encouraged. Today the society is one-sided, seeing only to the material aspect. Because of that, that is also not perfectly done, because how can you separate the character of a person from the education? In fact, it's saying that if you educate someone who has a bad character, it's like putting a jewel on a snake's forehead. If you put a valuable jewel on a cobra's head, everybody will want to go for the jewel. But in doing so, they'll get bitten and they'll die. So giving education to uncultured people means that they misuse the education. Instead of having a proper spiritual consciousness, they have a consciousness to enjoy materially, to exploit, to control. So practically it's a criminal mentality. So to educate criminals, right, if you gave an education to terrorists and criminals, how they could avoid the law, how they could break the law more effectively, that would be defeating the purpose. But actually this is what's being done indirectly when people are not being spiritually encouraged. Then that means amongst those people who are going forward for these advanced, so-called advanced education, so many of them are simply in a type of enjoying criminal mentality. Ultimately, everything is the property of Krishna. So if we're taking from Krishna and we're not giving back to Krishna, we're not acknowledging that Krishna is the owner, that means that we're thieves. How can we take something from the owner without giving him anything or acknowledging his ownership? So this is basically what's going on. Modern society, they're taking from God everything that he's providing, but they don't reciprocate and give back to Krishna what he's due. So because of that, there is this imbalance in people's dhikarma, or materialistic activities are increasing more and more. So the devotees are basically doing all good fortune for people by accepting from that service and offering that service to Krishna. Some people directly come and render service in the temple by sweeping the floor or helping to do some any kind of service type something or help in some way. Others are busy working, giving their energy in exchange for money. Just like you can convert dollars into pounds and shillings, pence, francs, and marks and other forms of currency. Well, they're exchanging their labor into money. So that money they give to Krishna as devotees. In a sense, the devotees are acting like bill collectors for Krishna, like tax collectors rather, collecting the due. Since Krishna is unlimitedly the creditor, or they are unlimitedly in debt to Krishna, there's no limit on how much they can return to Krishna. But even by giving something to Krishna, they benefit unlimitedly, because normally people don't give anything back to Krishna. They want to keep everything for themselves. If they give something normally, it's also either as an income tax shelter or as some kind of a personal sentiment or name or fame. Somehow or another, if the donation actually goes, the contribution actually goes to Krishna, then they get sukriti or eternal spiritual benefit for that. Sometimes unknowingly, they do a service to Krishna that is called agyata sukriti, or spiritual credit given by an unknowing person. Here in this present verse, and the preceding ones, we can see some of the mood of Vatsalya Bhava. Vatsalya Rasa is the parental rasa. In this parental rasa, the parents are always trying to protect Krishna. Garga Muni and Nanda Maharaj are discussing their concern about Krishna's welfare, about his protection. For this reason, they're discussing this is the dangers, how to protect Krishna. This is the Vatsalya Bhava, feeling that Krishna is actually dependent upon them, that he is a ward, a dependent, that he has to be protected and cared for. And if they don't do that, then how will Krishna survive? So this is Dada. This type of relationship is possible because of the intervention of Yoga Maya. Yoga Maya is like the, you can say, stage manager of the whole leelas of Krishna. He allows, she allows rather that everyone exactly has that particular mentality they need to perform that service. If Vasudeva and Gargara and David, excuse me, if Nanda Maharaj knew that Krishna was God, the tendency might be, well, what can we do to protect God? God can protect himself. He's the all-powerful, all-famous, all-knowing. So how to protect the Lord? If you know he's the Lord, there's no question of protecting. It's only when Yoga Maya covers that ability to see Krishna as the Supreme, and one sees Krishna according to one's devotional relationship, where you see Krishna as a boy, or as a friend, or as a lover, or as a, like that. And then accordingly, the devotee acts in that relationship. So, in this way, of course, that doesn't interfere with their love for Krishna, rather, that allows the love to flow more naturally, without artificial consideration that Krishna will take care of himself, and so on. One actually feels in that relationship that if I don't feed Krishna, Krishna will starve. So, in this way, Mother Yasoda, she's always very concerned for protecting and taking care of Krishna. Even though these two demons come and take Krishna away, and miraculously Krishna gets saved, it never, hardly does it dawn on anyone that Krishna himself is God, the Supreme Lord. They consider that Krishna is blessed. He's always being protected by God. Sometimes they get a hint, they get some vision, and they think that, oh, how is it possible? Who is Krishna? Krishna, he must be some great demigod or incarnation. Otherwise, how can he do these amazing things? But then again, Yoga Maya covers their bad vision, so they can simply see Krishna in their loving relationship. Otherwise, to think that Krishna is Krishna, it actually interrupts the flow. Similarly, those people who preach, or who preach and have to show mystic powers to their followers, that is considered to be at a much lower level than instead of a natural love of a servant for a master or a disciple for the spiritual master, and for appreciation of the spiritual gifts, then there's more of an awe inspired by seeing some kind of mystic powers. And one's attraction is more for the mystic powers, in most cases, than actually for the spiritual message. In a situation where the people are very materialistic, very unsubmissive, very unable to understand the spiritual subject matter, and something is needed just to overwhelm them so that they start to listen, then such mystic powers are sometimes displayed. Narada Muni displayed them sometimes. Sometimes they're displayed by different acharyas. Sometimes, of course, other preachers may have it displayed, but Srila Prabhupada explained this is considered to be at a much lower level than actually if someone has faith simply by hearing. That is the actual spiritual process. Otherwise, the faith just by seeing something miraculous, this is a more superficial faith, more sentimental faith. That the perfection of religion is when we actually become attracted to hearing about Krishna. To actually be attracted. To the messages of Krishna, to what to hear about Krishna, to have faith in those words of Krishna. Vishakshena Tadasujat Mapalya Vidya Team Same Eva Kevala. That unless we come up to that stage, we're not considered to have fully utilized our energy in this human birth. We should come up to the stage where actually we have an affinity for hearing about the messages of Krishna. But actually when we hear about Krishna, that time our mind becomes fixed. We should make our mind just like a slate board, like a blackboard. Where the spiritual master is writing the message of Krishna there on the consciousness. So, people now, their minds are so disturbed that Srila Prabhupada explained, and it's very difficult, even on the street if we try to explain them something, basically, it's very difficult for them to understand. If they take the books home with them, read in their own peaceful living room or whatever, so I don't know, maybe their living room's not peaceful, probably just all the violent movies and things, but anyway, they may have an opportunity somewhere during their day to read in a little peace and concentration and understand. Therefore, for this particular day and age, to somehow or another get the people to have books which they can read and try to understand this philosophy, this is by far the best process. Also, it allows for one person to reach many people, because how long can we spend with each person? On the street, unless they come up to a certain level, it's very difficult for them to understand anyway. So, giving them transcendental literature is the best opportunity for them to make spiritual advancement. Even a person, I understand that now we're doing a marathon for contributing to the book trust, for being able to distribute more books. It's a very important. This is the way that the people of New Orleans and the visiting people will be able to get the maximum purification, is by doing service and by getting the opportunity to lead the transcendental literature for trying to hold the name of Krishna. The time. People spend for all their material pursuits, nothing will they take with them. Everything will be destroyed and their body is destroyed. They can only take certain reactions which they'll suffer and enjoy in the next birth. But physically, whatever they've accumulated, even if it's millions of dollars, everyone knows they can't take it with a red cent with them. What to speak of enjoying the things that they accumulate. But whatever spiritual activities, pious activities they perform, that they can take with them. Normally, the more materialistic a person is, the more sinful activities they perform, especially in the present day and age. So therefore, in the next life, it's very unlikely that a rich person is again going to be rich unless they actually perform spiritual activity. It says that a devotee who fails to complete their spiritual activities, they can take birth as a son or daughter of a yogi, of a brahmana, or of a rich vaishya. To some people, they may take birth even in wealthy families. That's to give them an opportunity to engage in spiritual life, because they have no material worry. But everyone knows, especially in the modern day, that someone who's born in a very wealthy family, they become very pampered, very what they call footloose and fancy free, accustomed to just doing whatever they want, going anywhere, and especially in the modern day, they develop so many bad habits because of that. Like in the South, what they call filthy rich or something. But even though they're wealthy, their character becomes rotten because of not having proper association. So, this is a problem, that someone may have had spiritual credit from the previous birth, be born in a wealthy family, not had any material problem, but due to the present materialistic period, they get sucked into all kinds of materialistic activities, intoxication, gambling, illicit sex, and so on, eating. So even though a person might have had some devotional credit, because otherwise thus causing one to get that type of pious birth. If one is born with wealth, good looks, with an education, or in an aristocratic family, that is considered to be the result of previous pious activities of previous births. And some of those people may even be devotees from their previous life. When they come in contact with devotional service, they become immediately attracted. That is a symptom that they have performed devotional services in their previous life. Some people, when they come, they are not so much attracted. They have to, it's like pulling teeth. They have, by association, they may also become devotees. But for them, it's very difficult to practice the sadhana. Even people might be friends. One person may have been a devotee in the previous, one other person may have done hardly any devotional service. So, even though someone may have been a devotee for 10 lives, and never been a full devotee, just always been doing something but not very, perfected. But so they may be able to advance very rapidly, because one will take up where one leaves off. Well, another person who is actually having very little credit from previous life, but then it may be more of a struggle. They have to take the mercy being given by the pure devotees, and then they can also make rapid advancement by mercy of Guru and Vaishnava. But even if someone is born in a good situation, because of having been a devotee in the past, one has to be very careful, because of course, even for the short time we're in this material wealthy family, for instance, we may get so many bad habits, and we may adopt an enjoying attitude, which would be an impediment for advancing Krishna consciousness. We should transform the enjoying attitude to one of trying to please Guru and Krishna. That if Guru and Krishna are satisfied, that is our enjoyment, that is our happiness. Not that our own sense pleasure is the standard of happiness. Sense pleasure is actually very despicable. It's very disgusting. Because the senses, after all, are just instruments of dead matter. And when we come down to the level of trying to satisfy the senses, we just become entangled more and more. It's a very sudra mentality to want to enjoy the senses on that type of level. We can see here the twice born, they are concerned always with advancing spiritually. The demons, they're always concerned with increasing their sense gratification. And the demigods, of course, sometimes demigods, they also fall into the syndrome of wanting to enjoy their senses, but not at the sacrifice of their spiritual advancement. That is very rare. Generally speaking, the demigods, they want to, even they have material desires, but they don't want to sacrifice their spiritual position for that sense gratification. A prime example is when the demigods and the demons were having the tug of war. The demons and the demigods both were churning the ocean. And when nectar was produced, someone other, by tricks, the Rahu, he was able to get the nectar. But, so then Krishna appeared in the form of Mohini, or the beautiful form of a beautiful woman. And naturally the demons, they became very attracted because they were always in an enjoying attitude. They weren't as concerned about getting the eternal nectar as they were with enjoying the beautiful woman, enjoying sense gratitude. But the demigods, even though they were also able to see Mohini, they were more concerned with how to get this eternal nectar. Why give up eternal nectar just because of the beauty of sense attraction? Somehow or another, of course, Rahu, one of the demons, was able to get nectar into his mouth, but the Sudarshan chakra then chopped off his head, so it didn't go down into his body. It just got up to his neck. But because of that, Rahu was able to survive. His head, at least, became eternally immortalized. So, of course, today is an eclipse, and astrologically, the Rahu and just the opposite of Rahu in the Ketu is the presence of this Rahu demon. I heard from some scientists that astrologically, there is some kind of a invisible force which is in the places of Rahu and Ketu. They take it to be that there's some kind of a vacuum or something produced because of some kind of a force produced because of the moon and the earth lining up. Others have said that they've recorded that there's some kind of a planet which is not visible, but which radio waves, other things, they don't bounce off of in the same way. They can see that there's some kind of a globe there, which is not normally visible, but there's some kind of a body in there. We hear different things. Normally, scientists do not publish their discoveries if it doesn't match up with the prevailing theories. If it's too far out, then they're not able to explain it. They just don't tell anybody about it. But there's an institute in Texas, I heard, that has taken all these discoveries that nobody can explain. And this is, there's some discoveries like this, which are some of them. And out of curiosity or something, out of something, I don't know exactly what the purpose is, but there's supposed to be some kind of a foundation that actually maintains a list of all these different discoveries. In any case, the point I was trying to make is that how demons, they're very attracted to enjoying the senses, so much so that they completely forget about the opportunity to get immortal life. Give sense gratification strong enough to forget. So we have to be very careful against this demoniac attitude. But we forget about our spiritual progress out of a desire for enjoying comforts and sense gratification in this life. Because those things are very cheap. Even you see a dog, and you see that when it's a cold night, like last night was a cold night, you see that in one corner of the bar, where all the cowherd boys had burned up some hay or something to warm their hands, and there was ashes there. You'll see a dog go lay in the ashes, nice soft ashes, stretching out the warm ashes of the little fire there, relaxing in great comfort. Of course, our idea of comfort may not be ashes, but well, for the dog it was a soft, warm bed, and he stretched out and was enjoying it. So this idea of enjoying or just being lazy or having comfort, that's even there in the animal species like bears and dogs and so on. But that's not very glorious. But to use our full energy for satisfying Krishna, not leaving any stone unturned to serve Krishna, that is actually glorious. Even better, of course, in taking birth, getting back to the other point, taking birth in the family of someone who's wealthy is to be born as a devotee in the family of yogis and have the opportunity, like Krishna showed, what is the Vedic culture of having the parents take every spiritual precaution or effort to see to the maximum spiritual benefit of the child. All of these things require continuous cultivation of spiritual life, Krishna consciousness. In this way, it is possible for a human being to go back home, back to God. Even if we're born in a lousy family, even if we're born in some kind of despicable situation, still, by the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, we can still have, there's still hope for us. Don't lose any hope. There's still hope. Even if someone was born in a less fortunate situation, materially, by the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. In other words, one person may be born, just like in a race, some people, they get to go up on the front. Because in the previous races, they did fairly well. So they get to, like in Indianapolis 500, the winners of the previous races, they could be in the front line. And other people had to be behind them. But, once the race begins, even if you start in the back, well, if you can move up and pass and you run a good race, you can still come up from behind and win. Especially if the people in the front don't keep the gas pedal down. Right? So, that may be alright, just that, alright, one person, they started off with a little bit of an advantage from previous races. But they have to take advantage. They can't rest on their laurels. They cannot rest on the laurels if they want to win. But of course, this is not that kind of competition. You want everybody can be a winner. All you have to do is finish the race. If you finish this life in Krishna consciousness, you're a winner. But time is the factor. We are racing against time. Time is not stopping for anyone. Every breath is counted. If we miss enough time, we waste it by not using it in Krishna consciousness. We may not be able to have got far enough in the race of life that when our time is up that we may not be Krishna conscious. So we have to be very careful that whenever the final whistle blows, whenever it's time for us to leave this body, that we're actually in Krishna consciousness. Of course, we don't know when that's going to be. So we have to be prepared that it could be even the next second. We should think like that. I could leave this body any time. So at any time I should be prepared and I should be always clinging to the lotus feet of Guru and Golanda. This way, then at every moment we're very safe. So we have our immediate contingency plan will be always a keeping one or two hands clinging to the lotus feet of Nityanagora. And then we have a long-range program where we're trying to purify our consciousness through Krishna consciousness. And especially the most purifying thing is to give Krishna consciousness to others in a sacrificial mood, with great sacrifice and endeavor, trying to reach as many people as possible. Because even if one of those people become Krishna conscious, that alone would be enough to deliver us, even if later we have difficulties. What to speak if we are able to bring many people to Krishna consciousness and we ourselves remain strong, but we become very much noticed by Krishna, we can receive His special graces, and this way we can be reinstated in our transcendental position very quickly. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama. So these marathons are very good because that allows one to really turn up the gas for a little while, and this builds up one's spiritual stamina. One has to be very careful versus late, but one has to be very careful to always keep up the spiritual practices simultaneously, even if it's somewhat on the run. Hare Krishna.
Thank you.
which way they're calculated. All I know is that the Veda calculation also tells you that completely it puts you there. How they come to their conclusion, that's how the Veda, that's the people that are researching it. But obviously it's an observable thing. But the basic cycle between the earth and the sun and the different luminaries, this is calculable. Even though the calculation is on a different angle, it's kind of a similar result. To say, beginning at the Vedic time, 5,000 years ago, and they can see why it's a different calculation. Of course, and other things, so we don't get into this type of detailed discussions with people. Srila Prabhupada said, first let them try to understand the things which they can see in their own life. These are second facts. The fact is that, I mean, in my country, I'm here. They took him months to travel by horse to Kurukshetra. They didn't have any advantage. Even they didn't have telescopes. By astrological, it's a mathematical calculation. But the scientists say that the earth is turning. The Vedas say that the sun is also moving. And that the sun's orbit in juxtaposition with the earth, that the sun is also moving, and that different other luminaries is also moving in the earth. And that some may be going about each other, but those are, they're also moving. So that's why you get there's various phenomena which actually the scientists don't really have an explanation of. But they're able to figure out when there's solar eclipses and lunar eclipses are, but there's a lot of things that the candidates come out. But whether you say that this one is stationary and that one's moving, even now, they're admitting that the sun is also moving, but exactly how the sun's moving, because there's no other luminary nearby that they can use as a reference point. So in space, if something's moving, how do you know? You know, it's all relative. If you sense, just like when you're in a car, another car is moving, it's like sometimes when you go on the train station, and you actually stop, and the other train's taking off the other way, you look out and say, we're moving. So it's relative. There's movement, but then the question is that who is moving? At what speed? You know. The scientists say, no, the earth is moving and the sun is stationary. But the Vedas say, no, the sun is also moving. You know, so this is just the question. To verify that, of course, That's where we, which especially assigned to our Bhaktivedanta Institute, but that's not really, not individual members, but some of them are studying that. So that Sri Vishnupad is building some models to show and how the modern theory of astronomy has many fallacies, and that the Vedic astronomy is actually more scientifically. Just like there's an effect where stars are wiggling in the sky, which the scientists, they say it's due to atmospheric conditions. But the Vedas say that there's other than other causes. So these things are explained in the Vedas, but in the modern science, they just kind of, well, it's just atmospheres. So he's presenting a whole report for them, for putting in their big temple mindfulness. But there's a lot of different, because the main problem is they were trying to figure out, well, what about Rahu and Ketu? And then, you know, there's nothing in modern science about that. And it doesn't always exactly match up exactly the way they say certain things when you actually go into it. But that's when they found out that about this other organization in Texas that kind of collects all the discoveries that they can figure out and try to shove them under the rug. And then there it says that there are, they call it a black hole, or just, you know, they have different, like, words for it. They don't know what it is.